accession number 24654, Rail 1.
Good morning, Jack. Thank you very much for offering to be interviewed for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive. Can I please start by asking you for your full name and your service number, please?
Well, my full name is Jack Augustine Fielder, F-I-E-L-D-E-R, and my service number as another rank was 601-6046, and as an officer, 261-665.
Thank you. And where were you born?
I was born in Tottenham on the 20th of November 1920.
And
very near the Spurs ground.
Near the Tottenham Hotspur?
Yeah.
And 1920, okay. And your parents, what did they do?
My father, at that time, was a tram conductor. My mother was doing nothing at the time, to my knowledge.
A housewife bringing up the family.
Yeah, yes. We only lived there for about 4 or 5 years, and then we moved to Dagenham in Essex.
Right.
And then later on, my mother did actually go to work and work for the rest of her life.
Before we come back to what your parents did, any brothers and sisters?
I had a brother, Patrick Dennis Fielder. He was born on the 11th of November 1922, and he was actually born in Leon C, and he was born in our grandmother's house.
Right. That is extraordinary. We will come back to that. So you moved to Dagenham at the age of 5, and your father remained a tram car conductor.
He remained, yes, for several years, and then he spent the whole life with London Transport. And then later on he became a trolley bus driver. And then after the war, went on to what they call their regulating staff, sort of an inside man.
Right. Mm. And the work that your mother undertook once she had finished having her children?
Yes, she went to work for a company called the Provident Clothing and Supply Company. She was one of their agents, and she was one of their top agents, in fact. She did very well, and she was actually earning more money than my father, so we lived in a certain amount of comfort as a consequence.
And would that be unusual for a woman at that time to have earned more than her husband?
Not really. The particular type of job she was doing, she happened to be a very successful one, but the particular type of job she did was, a lot of women did it. I'd probably be 50-50.
Right. So that caused no tension?
None at all.
Even today, sometimes, men
no,
don't well, like
no whatsoever.
Right.
My mother and father were not their sort, you know. They got on very well together.
Can you tell me what an agent is? What was an agent of the...
The Provident Clothing Supply Company, what they did was a form of hire purchase for all sorts of things, but more often clothing. But they're not always only clothing, furniture as well. They issued cheques, and people were then able to take that cheque to a shop that dealt with the Provident. In fact, most shops took what were known as Provident cheques. It was a bit of a precursor to the Barclay card, in a sense.
Yes. Yeah.
And she issued these and collected the money. And she was paid entirely on commission, but she had what they called a book, like the insurance men had books, and they could sell their book to somebody else, and then she had a book which was a very large one, So she did rather well, actually.
And you tell
she
your
was
book
actually, just to jump ahead a bit, killed doing the job. She was killed by a hit and run.
And then what year was that?
No, I can't remember exactly. I've got the date. 1965, I think.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So she was still working in 65?
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
She would have been at least 65, would she not?
No, she was... Yes, I think she was 67.
Right. Mm. Okay. Mm. So you're in Dagenham, you're growing up there. Where did you go to school, Jack?
Went to school... very near, well, near where we lived actually, is a primary school, and I went to a secondary school in the same area. Unfortunately, I never took a scholarship because I had a very serious accident as a boy of 10 or 11, fell out of a tree, broke a bone in my back, and it's a very severe concussion. And I was off school for nearly a year.
Right.
During that time, scholarships went and passed, and because yeah. I missed all that, and subsequently I left at school at the age of 14, nearly 15.
You left school at 15 and with no significant qualifications?
Not really, no.
And what did you do?
Well, I went to work in the fur trade in London.
What attracted you to the fur trade?
Pardon?
What attracted you to
that? Nothing. That was where the job was to start with.
Right.
But he turned out to be quite interesting. I was a sort of an apprentice, trainee for valuation and that. But unfortunately, the company that I went to work for had a couple of burglaries. And as a consequence, a very old, well-established, very famous company in the fur trade. And unfortunately, that drove them out of business. So they had to fold up. Because you can't insure the furs you hold. It's a long, complicated story, but it drove them out of the business, so I had to leave the fur trade. And I went into shipping, into a shipping agent, firm of Martin Bencher in Leadenhall Street. I was there for a couple of years.
And so we're now about 1938?
About 1938, you're quite right, yes. And from there, I went to work in a similar sort of job, but for a menswear company, manufacturing, very high-class menswear company, in Dorston, in North London, as a shipping clerk, and I handled their exports. And I was there until the war broke out.
The war breaks out in September 39.
Yeah.
And what do you do?
Ah, well, you see, I have to go back a bit. Because... during the Munich crisis, I thought about joining the Territorial Army. I delayed it a bit for various reasons, and I actually joined the TA in March 39, the Essex Regiment, which was my local regiment. So we went to camp in July, and towards the end of camp, we were being told, you're going to be mobilised. Long before, not long, I mean, we're talking about a month before the war broke out. In practice, we weren't actually mobilised until called up until about the 27th of August before the war broke out. And I've still got my calling up notice.
So,
there was a young 18-year-old private soldier in the Essex Regiment.
Ready to go. And then you started your training, I assume, or had
well,
you really
I mean, we trained as a TA. Training. I mean, yes, we didn't do much training. We went straight into a what you might call an operational role, because our first job was to go and guard the oil refinery or oil depots, really, of Shellhaven.
Oh, right.
So I was in Shellhaven for a couple of months, and which was pretty grim, very, very grim conditions. Appalling, I mean, when I think, reflect back upon it, totally under-equipped, we had practically nothing. I mean, I remember in my platoon, every platoon had a particular set of oil storage areas to look after, and we were on permanent guard, virtually, and I can remember we had 5 rounds of ammunition between us, and half a dozen sentry positions, but only about one sentry position was allowed to have a round of one round. The rest of us, in our orders, we've made clear that if you saw somebody, you wanted to halt them, you opened and closed the breech smartly, as though you were loading. You didn't have any ammunition. We had wooden mortars and things like that. And the other extraordinary thing about it was, I was there, of course, when 3rd of September and the war broke out, and there we were. And we had a troop of Rough Riders, the County of London Yeomanry, the Rough Riders. And they had 4 AT-AT guns to guard the whole of Britain's petrol reserves, as far as I can imagine. And these 4 guns had 4 different calibres, and the ammunition was again 4 different calibres again. So when September the 3rd, when 11 o'clock went, and within minutes of that going, as you may have heard about, you weren't alive at the time, the sirens all went. And there was our AT-AT guns going across the sky, but there wasn't a round available to actually fire them. I mean, that was a joke. So we were there until about November. And then we were moved to Butlin's holiday camp at Clacton to guard the internees. So it became the internment camp and prisoner of war camp. And most of our prisoners, most of them there were Germans or European people that had been rounded up and interned, mostly Germans, but a few German sailors that had been captured at sea immediately after the war broke out. And we were there until about January, February. It was a very, very comfortable post because we had the benefits of the Butlin's holiday camp, which of course was closed, but I mean the conditions were very good. And then we took this lot down to Seaton in Devon, which was another holiday camp owned by Pontins holiday camp at Seaton. And we took them down by rail. It was a most interesting journey because we actually took these steam trains right through the underground system because we couldn't let them off. So it was all under guard. And we left them, we handed them over at Seaton. And from there we went up to... We went to Suffolk, to Leiston, or in the Suffolk area generally. Oh no, we went up to Sunderland. We went up to Northern, I forget them, because we went up to Durham. And we were there during the Battle of Britain, well, 1940 anyway. By that time I had been promoted fairly rapidly actually.
Before we come back to your promotions, just excuse me for 1 second. Jack, if I can just, before we continue, if I could just take you back to this extraordinary lack of equipment which you had when you were at Shellhaven, and which the AT-AT gunners also had. Did that, what was the state of morale? What did people think, both the officers that you met with and under whose command you were, and also the men with whom you served? That here was your government who knew that war was coming for at least a year from Munich, if not longer, and yet nothing seems to have been done. What did you think about that?
I didn't think that we gave any thought of about it at all. I think we thought that this was sort of a normal situation. We didn't. We anticipated that we'd be fairly well equipped pretty quickly, and I do remember. On one occasion, we suddenly got a box of 1,000 rounds of ammunition. We thought we were off to France the next day as a consequence. So, I mean, it didn't pass through. I mean, I should have said that, and I think it is relevant from a historical point of view, when I joined the TA, I joined the 4th Battalion of the Essex Regiment. Now, at that moment, the TA doubled within a week or so of us me joining. And then we became, the 4th Battalion was divided into two battalions, and I then became the 2nd 4th Battalion of the Essex Regiment. And that was common in most regiments. Most infantry regiments at that time doubled. So that was the rapid expansion of the TA. And of course, shortly after that, they introduced conscription, although that didn't directly affect us. And So we were very proud of the TA. I mean, I can always remember, shortly after the war broke out, before the war, everybody in the TA wore a T on their epaulette to show they were Totals. And we were proud of that T, and then we were required to remove them in case we were ever taken prisoner, and you know, the enemy would know we were Territorials and not as good as regular soldiers or whatever. And we were very angry about this, and none of us, we all practically refused as a battalion to remove them, but we had to in the end. So we all wore them under our collar, so we could do that. And it was particularly important because we started being reinforced by regular soldiers of various types, and regular NCOs would come and join us, reservists in some cases. And my battalion, and this is relevant, my battalion was very strongly influenced by the fact we had a regimental sergeant major from the Irish Guards, a chap called Jim Lunane. And he was, at that time, the senior regimental sergeant major in the British Army. And he was our RSM. He had the military medal, which he got at Mons. And of course, we at that time, we were very strongly influenced by World War One. I mean, many of our officers had Boer War medals, and yet when you think back, it was not that long ago at that time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we had a CO from the Guards, Lord Edward Hay, from the Grenadiers. So we were very strongly influenced by the Guards. All our drill, everything we did, our attitude was very, very dominated by Guards' ideas. So much so, and I remembered this for the rest of my life, really. I misled you when I said we went to Durham. First of all, we went to Leiston in Suffolk, and we were guarding that coastline, Sizewell, Aldborough.
Shall we just wait for this plane to go over?
Yeah.
I think the aircraft's gone away, so if you'd like to continue, please.
So, as I said, we were at Sizewell, and very strongly influenced. And at that time, I suppose this was about January 1940, may have been Christmas, about that time anyway, I went on what they call an NCO's cadre course to become, which I did become, an acting unpaid lance corporal. A provisional acting unpaid lance corporal. It was even lower than that. But that cadre course was actually conducted by this RSM, who drilled into us that once you're an NCO, you mustn't talk to men and mix with them and fraternise with the private soldiers and bring him back some of the Guards' ideas. And that sort of, you know, one remembered all that at the time. And just jumping ahead a bit, because it's relevant to my thinking, that man had the most enormous influence on me, and he was partly responsible for me being commissioned eventually. But that was the sort of the way the battalion was run, and very successfully. So for as far as we were concerned, orders were orders, and we all did what we told, and we high standard of drill and turnout and discipline, which may not have been common in all those TA battalions that were called up.
What was the standard, if I may ask, what was the standard of the military training, the infantry tactics, the military training that you would have had?
To be honest, we did very little military training. We were straight on guards and duties and things. The opportunity to do much training Baba Neville of a most individual section level was pretty remote. It was some months before we actually got down to doing training as I subsequently understood it and was involved in, because we were almost permanently guarding things. I mean, for example, I mentioned Sizewell. One of our major jobs in my company was to guard the first radar stations that were up on the coast at Southwold. Well, we didn't know what these were we were guarding, but we just saw RAF men sitting in a caravan and all in tents in freezing cold weather, snow, ice, and they were shinning up these masts in their RAF uniform. Of course, they were boffins dressed up in RAF uniform. At the time, we didn't realise that these were going to be vital to the defence of Britain, but we just thought there was some form of communication.
And so this is the very early few months of 1940.
That would be sort of January, February 1940. This is before the war actually really broke out in France. Yes. Before that.
And then you went up, so after this...
And then after there, we then went to Durham.
You then went to Durham.
Well, we went to Sunderland's and there. And we were building pillboxes along the seafront there, in particularly in Saltburn, where my company was. Another interesting, relevant point. We built all these pillboxes made of sandbags and concrete and stuff. By this time, I'd been promoted to a full corporal, a proper soldier, a proper corporal. And in fact, at that same place, I then became a lance sergeant. All this in about 6 months. At the age of 19, now I was this young lance sergeant.
What is a lance sergeant?
Well, it was a corporal. It's a rank that's still in the it's still in the guards, but the rest of the army has dropped it years ago. It's between corporal and sergeant, but you will still wear three stripes, but you're not quite a full sergeant.
So notwithstanding that you were still in the 2nd, 4th Battalion of the Essex Regiment, in fact you had adopted guards' mannerisms and styles.
Well, it was the way the battalion, yes, because we still had our guards RSM and our guards commanding officer.
Right.
Although most of the company commanders were Essex TA men. We had, I think, the second in command was a regular Essex man, but there were very few regular soldiers. We started to get regular soldiers coming in. Our company sergeant major was a regular soldier. He came in subsequently, a very good man. And but going back to our pillboxes, because we were there right through the Battle of Britain, sorry, not the Battle of Britain, the fall of France. We were still there, and the early days of the Battle of Britain, and I can remember a particular instance. Going back to pillboxes, my company commander was a very bright chap. He'd invented or worked out a device to enable us to fire a Bren gun from a pillbox aperture, through the pillbox aperture, on what was called fixed lines. It was a way of securing exactly the line of fire you wish to achieve accurately. It was an improvisation. It was unique. No one else had done this. I had, at this time, quite a reputation as I became a sergeant, a full sergeant subsequently, during this period. And I had quite a reputation for instructing, teaching weapons. I was a bit of a weapon training expert. And I used to demonstrate this thing for visiting firemen, so to speak. And they included Winston Churchill. I demonstrated to him. So that was in 1940. The Duke of Gloucester, who was a right pig of a man, and you can leave that on the tape, who said he'd seen it all, he couldn't have done it because we're here, but the only one. The Duke of Kent
Shortly before he was killed, actually.
Duke of Kent?
When was the Duke of Kent killed?
I can't remember. It must have been about 1940.
Was it?
Yeah. It was, anyway, he was killed subsequently. Okay. It may not have been quite as short as that.
Okay.
But it was the Duke of Kent. And, of course, a lot of the Chief of General Staff, you name it, I've demonstrated it to him at that time. That pillbox has been removed, but the base of it is still there. It is now a sort of sitting out area. And one of these days, I've been there and I've shown. I must tell those people, do you realize Winston Churchill was actually was here? It will have a plaque on it. Anyway, as I said, I became a bit of a... And another one of my interesting things, at that time they formed the local defence volunteers, which became the Home Guard. And one of the first local defence volunteer units in the country was Sunderland Tramways. And as a man, the whole of Sunderland Tramways joined the local defence volunteers. And I took them on their first parade on Roker Park football ground, Sunderland football ground, drilling, and they had the famous broomstick army. And they really did have broomsticks.
No weapons for them at all, yeah?
None at all. I mean, we were teaching them drill, but... And I can remember one of my first lessons for them was the brain gun. Well, they never got brain guns, but anyway, we were teaching them the brain gun. And literally hundreds of men with one brain gun than me. And in fact, that was the beginning. I might be able to mention it again later, but I did a lot of training of the Home Guard. Still as a, well, now of course a sort of semi-regular soldier, and it would be a part-time activity, and I did train in the Home Guard in various parts of the country. As the battalion moved around, I was the one that looked after the Home Guards of the area, so I got very much involved in the Home Guard. I could have quite a lot of funny Home Guard stories. I mean, Dad's Army is true. I've seen Dad's Army for the real.
Yes.
Anyway, we were there, as I said, we were there,
So you saw very little, then, of the Battle of Britain proper, which was taking place 300 miles away.
Well, in one sense it was, but we were getting air raids and things like this.
Were you?
Oh, yes. And one of our jobs, I mean, there was a fighter afield, at Ashworth Airfield, RAF Ashworth, which is in Durham. It was in Durham, which was a Polish fighter squadron. And we were guarding that at one time. I can remember these Polish pilots, they had to be limited in their fuel. When they took off, they weren't, you know, given a full load of fuel, because they might fly over to Germany, beat it up, not come back, not be able to get back. So, you know, make sure they patrolled more locally.
They were as mad as that, were they?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They were so angry, so... bitter about the Germans,
yes,
So as I said, we marched and dug up Durham and Northumberland and the whole of that area. And indeed, during that period, probably about 1941, I met Kathleen, because we were then stationed in Chesterley Street, which is also in Durham, between Durham and Newcastle. During this period, because of my weapons background, I'd been to the small arms school. And if you go to the small arms school and get what was called a distinguished, it's a fairly long course. It was, for another rank, it was the top thing to do. And I went. That was partly my friend, the RSM, made certain I went there. And I actually got a distinguished at the small arms school. And really, I should have gone back to the small arms school and transferred from the Essex Regiment to the small arms school corps. That was a corps by itself. But I managed to avoid all that. And I stayed with my battalion. And I became the weapon training sergeant, which is a key job for the battalion. You have two people to look after all the weapon training for the whole battalion, and from a sort of staff point of view, The weapon training sergeant and the weapon training officer. So I've worked as the weapon training officer, and therefore, for many months, was virtually, you know, my own boss. I mean, it was a remarkable job.
And that was why you avoided staying with the Small Arms Corps, because you knew that this opportunity was going to come up.
Well, not so much that. I still wanted to save my battalion. I didn't.
That was the primary reason.
Yeah, I really wanted to save my battalion. I did want to do this sort of job down in Hyde. Well, it wasn't in Hyde. They'd moved it to Bisley at the time. And I also went on a sniper course at Bisley, too. So I was a trained instructor in sniping. So I could shoot at the time.
You're obviously a very good shot.
I was a reasonable shot, I suppose.
Reasonable.
Well, I was teaching snipers, so I suppose I was good enough to be a sniper.
and that includes, of course, not only the ability to shoot, but the ability to camouflage yourself.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, we were actually... I mean, this is an interesting point, which I think records might like to have. Most of our instructors were... Well, many of our instructors were ghillies from the Highlands.